As all of you know, on Thursday, there were four more bombings, no real loss of life in London. Three subways and a bus was the plan once again, four different fellows apparently. And I think the only person who really lost his life was a fellow who ran and was shot dead in the door of a train, simply because in the new dynamic of terrorism, police have been given the instructions by the mayor and commissioner of police of Scotland Yard in London, immediately shoot to kill. They've been told there is now a new policy. If someone acts in a strange way, you cannot any longer wait for them to detonate and kill lots of people. And they have to be rendered unconscious. So the reality of our world is that in the, humanly speaking, the great city of London now, perhaps the single greatest city the world has ever seen, I could make a strong case for that, as I probably said before, at least it's wielded more power than any city the world has ever seen, unless you count Babylon after a different kind of means and power. Now, the new reality is that it has to be a headshot. Do not try to drop the person by hitting them in the leg. Immediately shoot them in the head. Now, I'm telling you this because a lot of horrified passengers, for the first time, all around this terrified man who looked up, watched these police who had him cornered, and under any other circumstances would have arrested him, had to literally execute him on the spot with bullets to the head and chest while people watched. It was a horrifying thing never seen in Israel or any of the nations of Israel, perhaps other than the nation in the Middle East called Israel, before. If it happened here, there would be inquiries of every kind. There is a new dynamic. Anybody who is told to stop must throw their hands up and open their fingers, and that's the only way they can save their life. Any other movement, they have to be dropped on the spot. Tens of thousands of police on the street in London the next day, and of course that day, that particular event happened at 10 a.m., and this man had been followed during the day. He was under surveillance. All right, now, things happen fast. Yesterday in Egypt, 45 people were killed in a place I have seen. I've been to that area. It's at the point of the Red Sea, and I've been to Haifa down at the point. I've been snorkeling there and was on a three-week trip to Israel in 1988, and just hundreds of yards away, literally, is Egypt. And so here off the Sinai Peninsula, not this time in Israel, as happened a year or two ago, there is a hotel bombing and lots of human beings died. I'm reminded, of course, that it's going to be like the days of Noah, where you read in Genesis, the earth was filled with violence. You can look up the word filled in the Hebrew and you'll find it means filled up. Just no more room for any more violence. In London yesterday comes this article. Londoners show true British spirit after bomb scares. London partied last night in defiance of the bombers who tried to bring carnage to the city. Thousands took to the streets to show they would not be cowed by the terror campaigns being waged against them. There was a Beat the Bombers street party staged in Shepherd's Bush, this square, just a few hundred yards from the scene of one of yesterday's explosions. Stranded commuters and evacuated local residents danced in the street until the early hours of today. Meanwhile, there was standing room only in bars and pubs around London, with many drinkers. Say they'd gone out of their way to go out on the town. They all insisted they would not be defeated by terrorism. The show of defiance in London came as it emerged that all four bombs which targeted the city are thought to have been nail bombs. Nail bombs shred people. They turn human beings into spaghetti. They didn't go off. Forensic examinations were carried out and so forth. There were certain places where 500 people would be seen dancing in the street. Let me tell you what that's called. That's called whistling in the dark. You ever heard the term whistling in the dark? It's where you're frightened, and so that you can't think about your own fear, wondering if a mugger will step out from behind a tree or a bush or a wall, you whistle in the dark to tell yourself you have nothing to fear. But reality is that it doesn't change anything in regards to threats that may be around you. No mugger will stop because somebody is whistling in the dark. Dancing in the streets is an empty, hollow way of drowning fear as they think, please, please, please don't let this intrusion hit me, not me. Now we're going to reach a time where I could probably start every single sermon each week, or whoever is speaking each week could start a sermon with the litany of tragedy and calamity in this sick, awful world. I read this week about the new trend. It was on page 3 of USA Today. It hit the internet about hundreds and thousands of kids strangling themselves just to the point of fainting so that they can get a high from the lack of oxygen. And in at least 9 states, kids have hung themselves to death because they fainted before they could snip the cord, fall down, and feel the high. And, of course, it's supposed to give a sexual high. So they're trying to strangle each other, kids, while they're fornicating, with the idea that they know when to just let go so that it intensifies whatever they're trying to do. Such is our world. It's the same world where they estimate that this serial pedophile who killed this little kid out in Idaho, I believe it was, they now believe has molested countless hundreds of children. One man. One of the ministers at headquarters was listening to a talk show this week in Akron where a caller called in to the host after same-sex marriage was approved in Canada. Officially, formally, about, I think, Wednesday, maybe it was. It was Tuesday or Wednesday. The talk show host fielded a call from a fellow who called in and said, I'm a pedophile, and we're next. You know, you have NAMBLA, North American Man-Boy Love Association. We want your children, and we are coming for them, and we're going to knock on your door and take your children, and you can't do anything about it. That's what he said. Because when you approve one kind of perversity and God is no longer the authority, why not others? At some point it'll be animals, and on it goes in this sex-drenched world. That's the way it is. Now I'd like to change gears, yet at the same time really we're on the same subject. What's the most important thing in your life? By perhaps the most important definition, if I can put it that way, it would be your answer to the following. What does your mind dwell on above all other things? Because whatever your mind dwells on above all other things is most important to you. Now, just think about the question. What is your mind on most of the time? Is it on your wife? Is it on your husband? Is it on your children? Is it on your job? Is it on your leisure? Is it your friends? Is it on your weekends, your upcoming weekends? Is it on your activities and other interests? Just what is it? What is it that your mind thinks about most of the time or above all other things? What is it? Now, I know that most of you recognize the right answer, or you should, that it is the work of the living God. But is that the honest answer? That's the right answer. That is the right answer. Whatever you put down, other than that's the wrong answer. As you hear it, presumably you understand it's the right answer. But is that the honest answer that you could give? We once understood, turn over to Revelation chapter 3, the whole church of God once understood that God raised up an entire era of his church for basically one purpose. Turn to Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7. Revelation 3 and verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, "These things says he that is holy, he that is true, he that has the key of David, he that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens." Now, let's stop for a moment before we read on. What is the key of David? The key of David is the knowledge of where the lost sheep of the house of Israel are. The watchman of the 20th century, the Ezekiel 33 watchman of the 20th century, who was also the messenger to the Philadelphian era, and that was Mr. Herbert Armstrong, learned the identity of the lost sheep of Israel. We all understood that the key of David was where those tribes are, like that letter in the announcements I was reading from a South African who said, "Well, where do I fit? I'm from South Africa. What tribe am I? I didn't see that in your book." Of course, it was in our books, I mentioned. Now, some have come along, and they no longer understand the key of David. Obviously, the apostates said it was something else. They were not Philadelphian, so they wouldn't understand what the Philadelphian messenger absolutely would have to have in clear picture and form in his mind and understand it, comprehend it fully. He couldn't possibly be the messenger, Philadelphian, not understand the key of David. He wouldn't have that key. Of course he would. Now, the leader of one of the big splinters has said it is government. The key of David is government, that Mr. Armstrong got it wrong. I tried to argue with this man and tell him he was absolutely wrong. He didn't even understand government, and he leads his church all wrong. That's another whole story. But he blew off the key of David. Others have misunderstood it, and, of course, the Catholic Church, like this particular splinter leader, believes it is government. So this confused man is now in agreement with the Catholics and believes that they know what Mr. Armstrong didn't know. Well, let's keep reading, because verse 8 directly comes off of verse 7. "And I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. You have but a little strength. You kept my word, not denied my name." All right. Now, an open door for what? I have set before this era an open door. Of course, Mr. Armstrong said in Mystery of the Ages and mentioned other times and sermons and letters. He wasn't sure whether it was in front of the leader or the era, but it doesn't make any difference, because wherever the era is or the remnant of the era is, there will be a leader, there will be people, there will be those of that era. Even if it's now the Laodicean age, there are people of sixth era thinking. Remember that letter I just mentioned? Here's a lady who was writing in, who's been to all kinds of groups in the seventh era, is now in a group of the fifth era, and is inquiring about us, the sixth era. So people get confused. But the sixth era had an open door, and no man can shut it. What was the door for? Now, Christ puts the door before us. He then obviously opens it for us. But we have to, of course, do our part by simply walking through it. It's just really that simple. The work that the work does is the open door. We have to do the work of God. Turn to Acts 14. Fascinating statement. I'm going to show you a different perspective than you've ever seen before on the subject of the work in the Bible. We're not the only people who understood doors and the work. Acts chapter 14 and verse 24. Acts 14 and verse 24. "And after they had passed through Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia. And when they had preached the word in Perga, they went unto Attalia, and thence sailed to Antioch, from whence they had been recommended to the grace of God for the work which they fulfilled. And when they were come and had gathered the church together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them, and how he had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles. Of course, Paul is rehearsing these things. God had opened the door of faith. And what did Paul do when he got to these places? He talked about the work that was being done. He recounted it. Fascinating statement. Paul gave the members of the church news of the work first, since it was the most important item of discussion. Chapter 15 and verse 4. Now here's the Jerusalem conference. Certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved. Well, that was wrong. When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. And being brought on their way, sounds like Paul was subordinate, doesn't it? He understood God's government. People try to say Paul was a lone ranger, a kind of a rogue first century minister doing his own thing, justifying different organizations today, that Christ can be divided if those are the circumstances. That's false. We all understand that. But I just want to point out, Paul said, we need to go talk to Jerusalem. He wouldn't do that if they didn't count, if they were some independent organization. That's not a picture of different first century splinters, as some have tried to say, to justify the fact that God's people are all split up in different organizations, when the real reason they're split up is they have departed from fundamental doctrines and can no longer agree and therefore cannot walk together. So when they had certain disagreement here, what did they do? They said, we got to get together and be sure we all teach the same thing. Now listen, watch this. See if you ever noticed this. And being brought on their way by the church, they passed through Phoenicia and Samaria, declaring the conversion of the Gentiles. And they caused great joy unto all the brethren. What did they do? They reported news of the work. And when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received of the church and of the apostles and elders. What did they do first before the conference? And they declared all things that God had done with them. They gave news of the work first, even before the conference. Now there were serious business. Conference involved some important issues. But I always start our conferences, and always will, with lecture number 2 after the keynote address. Mr. Armstrong always did it. The pattern was really left for me, and that is, I give what's called a state of the work address. Where is the work today? Because I want those two lectures, and I explained this last week in the summary, those two lectures to reflect all the way through and be a foundation all the way through the rest of the conference. We've established priorities. We understand why are we here. Why have you come from all over the world to sit in this room and talk about the things we're going to talk about? And once the foundation is laid, then everybody is on the same page and we can build sequentially, as I've done every year in the lectures, and some of you have been at all four of them and know that's true. And I'll always say, right in the very first lecture, the lectures build sequentially, and they always will. It takes a little more work to line your lectures up that way, but that's the way it has to be done. Turn to 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, the end of that first book to that congregation. 1 Corinthians 16, we'll pick it up in verse 5. The special offering was described there in the first four verses. Now, verse 5, now I will come unto you when I shall pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia. That's my plan. I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do that. That's my plan. And you've got to wait till I'm done. Now, keep following. And it may be that I will abide, yes, and winter with you, that you may bring me on my journey whithersoever I go. Remember, there's a door in front of this man. Keep watching. For I will not see you now by the way, but I trust to tarry a while with you if the Lord permit. In other words, the brethren came second in a way, I want to come. Maybe I can spend the whole winter with you if that's what God wants, but I have work to do in Macedonia. Let's keep reading. But I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. Why is he saying all this? For a great door, an effectual, is opened unto me, and there are many adversaries. Paul understood his responsibility is to walk through doors as they're presented. Christ's responsibility to show us the doors. He said, I have set before you an open door. Christ the Revelator in Revelation 3 says to us today, to Mr. Armstrong in the last century, I have set before you an open door. No human being, I couldn't, nobody else, Mr. Armstrong certainly couldn't, create a door and then open it. He couldn't do it. Christ has to do that. Our job is to walk through it. Christ has to, of course, point out the door and explain the door. Our works today is the work. So Paul said, a great door, an effectual, it's effective, it's a big-time door, is opened unto me. And of course, whenever that happens, I don't have to tell you, there are many adversaries. I've tried to tell the staff, and we had a meeting yesterday before we left, I think everyone understands by now, the work that the Restored Church of God is going to do is going to be mammoth beyond all proportion, and it's exploding. It's not going to grow slowly at 30%. It will dwarf that. We may have months that grow 30%. That's true, but it won't be years or a year. We will grow immensely fast to immense size. I think we all understand that, and I was trying to explain that in a way, think of an invisible glass wall 6 feet outside this building that is sort of Teflon and Kevlar. It's bulletproof glass. You know, Kevlar is bulletproof stuff, the stuff that vests are made of, the police wear and so forth, that protects us. It's sort of 6 feet out beyond the edge of the building. And for the rest of the age, in your mind's eye, see demons smashing up against that wall like a little child running into a glass door. They don't see it. They want in here. They send their agents. There are adversaries everywhere. If you will, picture the devil from time to time himself trying to penetrate this work, smashing up against that protective shield and wall. He cannot stop the door that has been set open before us. The sovereign God, and there are only two gods, we all understand that, the God of a trillion galaxies, the sovereign God, and the God of this world, who appears in many forms, shapes, flavors, colors, textures. He appears in many religions. He is a God. He's a very real God. He's not a fictional God. He's a real God, and he can appear in any number of ways. And then there's the true God. All religions are subservient to that false God except this church. This church and this church alone. Yes, the splinters, the big groups out there that came out of Worldwide are a mix of two spirits. As the oil goes out of them, I understand there's two spirits. There's another spirit, another Jesus, another gospel. They are compromising. They're selling out. That's why this church is exploding in growth all over the world and will dwarf the collective work of all of them. They don't have an open door in front of them. You must not, and I must not be confused about that. They do not have an open door in front of them. Most of them don't even understand the key of David and wouldn't want know what to take through the door if they had a door, and they have neither. We need to understand that. It's a great door, and it's an effectual door. And we have to move fast because it isn't the 20th century anymore. We're in year 6 of the 21st century, depending upon how you count the year 2000. We're well along. We're ready. We're locked. We're loaded. Powerful things are going to happen. Month after month, you'll see jumps, incremental jumps, the kinds of very exciting letters from all over the world that I read in the announcements that others can't hear, but you did. There's no time here. Will continue to accelerate and multiply, and they will come and labor with us, multiplying the impact of what can be done as long as we keep walking through the door. And I will keep opening Sabbath services here. The CAD staff will continue in the announcement bulletin to give news of the work. Mr. Armstrong lived to do the work. It's a veritable doctrine. And now you can begin to see it in the scriptures. Constantly talking about the work. Here is Paul delaying a trip that he wanted to do because of the work. And he was later criticized for it. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 2. Furthermore, verse 12, 2 Corinthians 2:12, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and a door was open unto me of the Lord. Now, I ought to stop here just for a moment and explain. I will have to be sensitive to what God wants me to do. I hope you will all be praying for me. I hope you'll be praying for the whole work at headquarters in this specific way. We have to recognize when Satan wants us to take a path and when God wants us to take a path, and which is which. Christ will always make clear as long as we are close to Him and we're listening for Him, we're walking with Him. We'll know when those doors are there. Immense decisions have to be made, and they have to be made on God's clock, God's way, as we walk through doors that Christ has opened, not any man has opened. I will have to be sensitive to God's Spirit and recognize when those doors are there. Turn to Colossians chapter 4. Mr. Armstrong saw all these verses. He understood. The Apostle Paul talked constantly in letter after letter, in visit after visit, about the work of God. Colossians 4 and verse 2. He writes near the end of the book now, the epistle, continue in prayer and watch in the same with thanksgiving. As you pray, constantly, constantly praying, and you're watching, remember to be thankful for what God is doing. With all praying also for us, that God would open unto us a door of utterance. He's saying, pray for the work to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in bonds. I'm in jail because of it, that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak, that I may make it obvious, which is the way I am supposed to speak. Pray about it. Now, the open door of utterance, brethren, is the most visible sign today of the end of the age. Of course, each day and each week and month that passes, there are other growing signs. There have been for quite some time. There were even in Mr. Armstrong's lifetime. Earthquakes, famines, pestilence, war, religious confusion, and division between and among nations, but it's intensifying. There are many signs, but the most visible sign today of the end of the age, and you may have never thought of it that way, is the extraordinary, miraculous, open door of utterance given to this church and no other church on earth. And you have a responsibility, so says God, through Paul, in the Word of God, to pray about that door of utterance constantly. Paul couldn't visit or talk to anybody or write without talking about the work of God. Turn to Matthew 24:14. We'll just review a basic verse here, and then I want to tell you something that maybe you old-timers in the faith noticed, and probably many of you didn't. But you might ask yourself, did you, when Mr. Armstrong made this change? I did. I noticed it. Matthew 24 and verse 14. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, Mr. Armstrong said for decades, let's do the work. You've seen those statements at the end of my coworker letters where I quote Mr. Armstrong. I continue to do that. I understand I could end those letters the way I choose to do, but I will continue to bring his extraordinary gift with words of urgency. But Mr. Armstrong changed at the end of his life. He phrased it differently. And he changed it to, let's finish the work. Let's finish the work. Very few, I don't say none, but very few saw that he shifted that. Now, as he reached his late 80s and 90s, particularly in his 90s, he talked more that way because he understood that his life was soon going to be finished. He thought up until near the very end that he might live, although I've told you he understood he could die and didn't want anybody to hang their hat on his physical existence, but that he might live, yet at the very end he understood it just isn't going to happen. There are things going on around the world that show prophecies advancing, but things weren't moving fast enough in Israel. Economic conditions were not such that as he reached age 92 and then 93 and eventually died at 93 and a half, he could tell that there were not sufficient droughts, terrible disease epidemics sweeping planet Earth, taking millions of lives. He could see that the Catholic Church and the 10 nations had not come together. And so he emphasized finish the work, partly because he knew his life was finished and Christ could surprise everyone. There could be a thief in the night sort of appearance. Miracles could be poured out in the Catholic Church. Europe could literally slam together, just wham, just like that. And the whole world would be in wonder. And, you know, droughts and famine could come quickly. But he also understood he needed to program to the brethren, if his life was finished, before the work was finished, that the brethren needed to be left with the burning message in their minds that they must finish the work. And as he said over and over, he was consistent on this through the decades, he knew it continued all the way to the tribulation. Now, how in the world there are hundreds and thousands of people confused about doing the work, that it's over, Mr. Armstrong was the only one able to do it. That's ridiculous. Why, those people could just look at the scriptures we've read right here about Paul. Paul did the work too. Paul didn't live in the 20th century. There have been other men who did the work. Somehow people get confused. And sort of like Catholics with Mary, you've heard me explain this, they focus on the man, Herbert Armstrong, and they worship the man, and they enshrine the man, and think the only man that was holy enough to do the work was Mr. Armstrong, and he would be the first to thunder at them, that they're viewing him like an idol, that the work transcends his life, because he said so, and you've read the quotes, I won't revisit them. Turn to Romans 9, Romans 9, and verse 27. Isaiah also cried concerning Israel, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant shall be saved. I always read that verse adding only, it makes it clearer. A remnant shall be saved, that's all. Just a remnant, merely a remnant, only a remnant shall be saved. For he will finish the work. Now, you don't have to have any doubt whatsoever whether God is powerful enough to finish the work. He is. It will be finished. And cut it short in righteousness. That is the plain warning to all with ears to hear and eyes to see, that it will be cut short in righteousness and that we will all think we have more time than we do. It can't feel cut short, or in fact be cut short, unless the prevailing feeling among God's people, who might be sitting on their thumbs when they could do more, is that there's more time. There's enough time. Now, right now, there's a lot of urgency in London. I'll bet our brethren in London see with a different level of urgency today than they did before 7-7, as it's being called over there. That's the first set of four bombings. And then 2 weeks later, 7-21. The second set, I'm sure it ratcheted up more. There was this hope, and I've read article after article after article, there was this hope it'll just be one time, then things will back off. Maybe it was just an aberration. And now it was a second time, so they're whistling in the dark, dancing, getting drunk. But you can't stop that unseen enemy. And it's here to stay, and our brethren are there. Why, anybody who's had the television on knows that one expert after another in the United States has said over and over again, it will happen here. The greatest single nation, Manasseh, the world's ever seen, London headquartered the greatest company of nations by far the world has ever seen, but the great nation here will also begin to see it once again. It won't be 2 weeks apart. Been a long time, a lot more than 2 weeks since 9/11/01, nearly 4 years, but they're waiting, like predators stalking prey. Their business is terror, And you understand God said, I will appoint terror. People don't want one to stand up and say that. It's my job to stand up and trumpet. God has sent the terror. Even the weak-kneed splinter leaders won't say such a thing. I know it's unpopular, but God says it, and we have to report faithfully what God says. Verse 28, cut it short in righteousness, it'll be the right thing to do, because a short work will the Lord make upon the earth. Just a short work. This is the end final work. And as Isaiah said before, except the Lord of Sabaoth had left us a seed, we had been as Sodom and been made like unto Gomorrah. I tell you, it's close to Sodom and Gomorrah when people call in on talk shows and say, we're coming and we're knocking on your door and we want your kids and we'll get them. Bold. Defiant. Hostile to everything of God. And if I were in this world, I'd be shuddering. If I had babies, I once had babies, I'll tell you, if I were in this world and had babies, and I am neither, I don't have babies, and I'm not in this world, I've got a bunch of grandbabies, and I sit and I look and I think, wow, what would I do? What would I do in the face of such a predator that society is empowering with laws designed to allow people to have individual rights that lead to horrifying things such as that. Matthew 24, back to Matthew 24. I've not forgotten the opening question. Now, I hope you haven't. What does your mind dwell on above all things? It's obvious what Paul's did. Anybody who has any memory at all knows what Mr. Armstrong's mind dwelt on all the time. Matthew 24 and verse 21. And then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, that's cut short. You know what you just read there in Romans 9? There should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. They'll be cut short. Now, at some point, if you're going to shorten those days, you have to shorten the work. There comes a point where the work comes to an end, and it feels like we had more time. Now, if the prevailing mood, and I've explained this before, at least in part, is my Lord delays his coming, and most of God's people were reveling with the world, and a lot of them are, then the fact is it would feel cut short. Now, if everybody knew it could happen tonight, and then another day passes, it could happen tonight, and they lived every day vigilant, watching with thanksgiving, as we read there, constantly praying for the work, then nobody would think, you know, it's years and years away. The days that Christ is speaking about that would lead to world cosmicide will be cut short as a direct result of the elect who have finished the work. The whole point is to protect them, the work that God is doing. Now, I understand some of the splinters are doing works. They have labeled it God's work. It is not God's work. God's work is done by God, where his people and his government are walking through doors Christ has established. Those are the people of sixth era thinking, continuing through the seventh era till the tribulation. It's for the elect's sake that God cuts it short. The rest of the elect in the seventh era go right into that tribulation and lose their lives with everyone else. It has to be talking about the people of the sixth era. It can't possibly be talking about Laodicea. It's impossible. They die with everyone else. It cannot mean them. Days are being extended now and then will be cut short for our sake. Those God is going to protect. If God weren't going to protect some, he wouldn't care. The whole world could be wiped out as far as that's concerned. Now, he also has the purpose. Some have to live over and repopulate the earth going into the millennium. He's not going to create another Adam and Eve. He has that purpose as well. He's going to allow some who weren't converted, about a tenth of mankind, to live on through, while the vast majority who had his spirit, those of the seventh era, die. The elect he has in mind, as well as the 10% who will live on over, are to keep society going, not as men want to keep society going, but also to protect those doing the work in this work. Yes, brethren, I'll say it plainly. People must be doing this work, backing up here, supporting here, where the door is opened, the door of utterance by Christ. Christ is not divided. You can't divide the unity of one unified, organized, structured church led by Christ among several organizations and several leaders. It's impossible. Christ is not divided. Oh, I know, we will have many adversaries, as we read. They don't want to believe. They didn't want to believe then that there was a door in front of Paul, and there were all kinds of would-be teachers of the law, deceivers, seducers, false prophets standing up and doing other things. You bet they were in opposition to a man who would stand up and say that he had a door of utterance and others did not. Of course, the other apostles did, which was the same church. God may allow opportunities for individuals here. It isn't just me. Other individuals may have an opportunity in a given moment to preach a powerful message, just as surely as Stephen, who was a deacon, could utter in a momentary door of utterance some tough things for which he died. There can be doors within the great door. Mr. Armstrong often would talk about, I believe a door is being opened to us. Now, he wasn't talking about the Revelation 3:7 great door in front of the whole era. There would be a great door. That door stood open until it was shut and no man can open it. But within the great door, there are other doors from time to time. A door of utterance here, a door of utterance there. Under the great door of utterance. Do we all understand that? Is that crystal clear in your mind? We will have to find out as we walk through the great door whether or not this, that, or the other smaller door is exactly what God wants us to go through. Is this what Christ is showing us? If an idea is born here in the office, we're thinking about this, that, or the other possibility. What if we did this? What if we did that? And, you know, lots of ideas and possibilities are discussed. Does God want us to do them? Now let's go to Malachi 4. Once again, let's ask this question a little different way. I talked about only the elect who are going to be saved from the tribulation could possibly be the ones that are referenced there in Matthew 24, 21 and 2. The elect of the seventh era who are losing God's spirit may still see their work burned and be saved, cannot possibly be the ones that that's talking about. The ones doing the work here. And by the way, that was just 8 verses after it said that the gospel will be preached in all nations. Christ isn't divided. He's doing it in one place. Now look at this. Malachi 4, 5, and 6. All know the verse, but let's look at it a little differently. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. Now we understand that is the Hebrew kerem. C-H-E-R-E-M, and it means utter destruction. That is a perfect mirror image of Matthew 24, 22. Now, the vast majority of those in the splinters do not understand even who the Elijah was. And as I've said in my book, in effect, this incredible prophecy, so big that if it was not fulfilled, God would have destroyed the earth. Some believe was fulfilled, and you can't know it was. As several leaders say, well, we don't know if Mr. Armstrong was the Elijah. They're kind of agnostics on that point. We don't know. You can't know. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. That's a political answer designed to sort of satisfy those who think he was in their group and to satisfy those who think he wasn't in their group. It's a cowardly position. Arguably behind the first and second comings of Christ, any prophecy that if it's not fulfilled, God would have destroyed earth is an immense prophecy. Well, is there any other big prophecy you know of that after it's happened, you can't know it happened? You've heard me ask those questions before. there will be a group who understand that prophecy and who are working, knowing that there's only one reason. God has not intervened and His work is not finished. They will be the elect of the sixth era who understand a door was set before that group, nobody else. They will be working. They understand God would destroy earth if it wasn't for the man whose understanding was restored. You know, God's understanding was restored through that man, all of those doctrines. We have held to them. I've explained again. Christ said, "Go and teach all things whatsoever I have commanded you to all nations." The Elijah restored all things. That's why we teach all things. And that's why the sheer awesome amount of work we can do with the goods, as I explained in the conference and last week's sermon, when most of the other splinters are worried about having services for their people. I don't mean Sabbath services. We've got the goods, they're into services. Their people want to be stroked and massaged and tweaked. They don't want to work. And we have to do the work. Work is hard. Look around you in the world at large. The work ethic is dead. Generation entitlement, pleasure, sex, and credit doesn't want to work. They hang on their cell phones. They don't produce. They lie around. We got a whole generation of couch potatoes. I was watching the news yesterday. Little kids now. They're talking on NBC News about how you no longer hear, "Come on in for dinner. Dinner's ready." You know why you don't hear that? Because the kids aren't outside anymore. They're sitting in front of video games. And they were showing how you used to go fishing. Today, there are video games where you fish. You used to go ride a bike. Today, there are video games where you use buttons and you ride a bike. And it's cyber biking. It's virtual biking. And they showed all these porky little kids sitting there. They're all fat. But the good news is mommy never has to come in. It just reminded me, took me back to my childhood, how my mother would yell out the door, "Dinner's ready, come on in." And we would come running. Video games when I was a kid, I don't have any idea what that would be. Today, you have a whole generation who wouldn't know how to live if their video games were taken away from them. It's as though they don't know there were 6,000 years of children who came out of the womb and lived whole lives and never saw a video game, never picked up a cell phone, didn't know what a personal computer was. They have video games now where you can swing in a swing set, in a virtual swing set, pressing buttons. The only thing that stands between us, brethren, and utter destruction is whether our hearts are in the work of God. Turn to Matthew chapter 10. I was reading this last night, you know, just before I went to bed. I lay down of a Bible beside my bed. Someone will just pick it up. And I just decided to read Matthew 10 and go through it. You know, "I send you as sheep among wolves," verse 16. "Be you therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves," kind of going through that. There are many adversaries of this work. I am not naive. But you come down to verse 22. "You shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. But he that endures to the end shall be saved." That is a direct byproduct. And try to think of what else it could be. A direct byproduct if you're part of an immense worldwide work. "When they persecute you in this city, flee to another. For verily I say unto you, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man be come." Adversaries everywhere. 1 Corinthians 9. We'll come back to Matthew 10 later. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 19. Look at how Paul thought. This was Paul's approach. Verse 19. "For though I be free from all men..." Paul was a Roman citizen. He was powerful. Evidence he had some wealth. He was on the equivalent of the United States Supreme Court when God called him. He was on the Sanhedrin. There's this Judge John Roberts from Indiana who may fill Sandra Day O'Connor's seat. And I can sort of relate. Paul gave up what, I guess in this case, we'd have to say a woman gave up. Now there's question of who's going to be confirmed, because everybody understands a seat on the Supreme Court is very powerful medicine. Probably one or two more under this president will be replaced. and there's going to be an all-out thermonuclear war in the Senate over who receives those seats because so much is at stake. Paul was free. He was free from all men. He had a great life. Yet have I made myself servant unto all that I might gain the more. It was all about doing the work and helping other human beings. He didn't know if he could gain the more. He said, might gain the more. We don't know how big the church will be. We might get big. We might not. I say big. We won't have time to get huge in terms of the size of the church. But because of the extraordinary door of technology, unlike any era in history, because of the extraordinary efficiency we have, and because of the massive amount of goods we have, the incredible size of this work could generate quite a few people quickly. Almost a certain problem. People don't grow too fast, come along toward baptism too fast, and yet it's hard to slow them down in this age. And I'm not about to try to slow people down. You can't. The normal 18 to 24 month incubation period of a prospective member from first contact to baptism, that's what it was, 18 to 24 months. That was always the way it was, because of the way the work was done in the 20th century, has now sped up to where people can almost explode through the literature. And there's no other way to do it unless we took it off the internet and decided to go by Pony Express and just go back to the 20th century. We slow everything down, pretend we've got decades. We don't have decades. So everything's up there, and people can read very fast and come aboard very fast, and we can grow bigger fast, and the impact can multiply very fast. Everything can happen very fast, just as fast as events in the world can develop. And we'll have to see what we might gain, how many more we might gain if we think like Paul. Yes, we live in countries as free people. Like Paul, as a Roman citizen, tremendous power. Got him out of jail once. You know, sheriff got real scared when he found out Paul was a Roman citizen. I didn't know. I'm sorry. You know, he had power. He had freedom. Very few had Roman citizenship. There are three categories in the Roman Empire. About 120 million people. 60 million were slaves. 50-50, you were a slave. Another 60 million lived free, but a very small percentage, relatively very small percentage of the wealthy, actually had Roman citizenship. Here, everybody has citizenship. There are three categories in the empire. Paul had Roman citizenship. He didn't need the muss or the fuss, and that's why he said, necessity is laid on me. And yet, he did everything in his power. He made himself servant unto all human beings because he had no idea when he might be dealing with somebody that Christ wanted to add to the church that day. Christ adds daily, you see. He didn't know. The work is done differently today. It isn't individuals always coming in contact with other individuals. It can be and has been in every age, including today. One of the reasons we are picking up speed in growth and size, and I said during the announcements we'd grown 5% probably in the last 10 or 12 days, is because more people are talking to others about us. There's a synergy. There's a buzz developing. People are pointing other people to our website. It's beginning to be known. We are the largest religious publishing operation in the world by far. There are millions of people who are coming to be aware of us. Millions. Not just thousands or tens or scores or even hundreds of thousands. Millions. And that begins to develop and take on a life of its own. The work Mr. Armstrong did is so big that people still 20 years later, nearly, after his death, talk about him and remember him, and constantly we read letters referencing him. I don't know how often we get letters saying, oh, wow, I'm so happy to have found the Plain Truth magazine. Please send me the Plain Truth. They don't even read carefully enough to say it's the Real Truth magazine because we just look the same. We just look the same. We feel the same. We talk the same. The message, the vibrations they get are the same. Turn to number 16, an extraordinary account here. One of the greatest servants of God who ever lived was Moses. Perhaps one of the greatest acts, if not the greatest act, in this great man's life was that he directly disobeyed what God commanded him to do. Look at that. Let's notice. Number 16. Now the people had murmured. The story of Korah is in this chapter. All these princes that died in verses 33 and 34. Verse 41. People murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "You've killed the people of the Lord." Fantastic, incredible. An earthquake opens up. I've often thought people are amazing. An earthquake opens up, and all these people slid down into the earthquake. And Moses had the power to create an earthquake. You have killed them? No, God had killed them. Do you wonder, brethren, whether the earth will open, swallow an army chasing God's people to the place of safety? Whether God's people who get away might be blamed by a carnal world for having killed an army when the earth opened up? Do you think it's possible people could do that? Be that confused and befuddled and angry and defiant that they actually think this little group that makes a getaway into a place of safety and an army is lost in their rearview mirror as the earth opens up, whether they might be blamed too? Of course they will. Well, they gathered against Moses and Aaron. Yes, people will gather against this work. Verse 44, the Lord spoke to Moses, and here's what he said. "Get you up from among this congregation. Get out now, that I may consume them as in a moment." All right. Moses directly disobeyed God. But what was his reason? They fell on their faces. Now, if God commanded you, "I command you, get out of this room. I'm going to kill everybody in this room," whatever room you might be in, would you do it or would you fall on your face? Moses said to Aaron, "Take a censer and put fire therein from off the altar and put on incense and go quickly to the congregation, make an atonement for them. For there is wrath gone out from the Lord. The plague is begun." I mean, this is serious business. Now, it's interesting. Aaron immediately obeyed Moses. Now, God told Moses to do something. He disobeyed him. Now, just follow. Extraordinary lesson and message for us today. Moses told his older brother, "Go do this," and the brother obeyed him instead of God. And Aaron took as Moses commanded. Now, that's amazing. Moses issues a command, Aaron obeys. God issues a command, Moses disobeys. Now, keep reading. "And ran into the midst of the congregation, and behold, the plague was begun among the people. And he put on incense and made an atonement for the people." Now, look, here he sees people just dropping dead. God didn't back off because they didn't obey him. He started the plague. And so Moses, I don't know how fast a man in his 80s can run. It'd be interesting to see. But here's a man in his 80s who could have had a heart attack, conceivably. He's in disobedience to God and he's running. No joke here, I'll tell you. "And he stood before the dead and the living, and the plague was stayed." This act of disobedience. Now, this is extraordinary. "Now, they that died in the plague were 14,700 people, besides them that died about the matter of Korah. And Aaron returned unto Moses, unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, the plague was stayed." Now, brethren, I'm not here to give you instruction about why it's okay to disobey God. That's not the point here. There's only one possible reason that God would stop a plague when two men directly disobeyed him and saved millions of lives as a result, is it was a test of whether or not those men loved the people whose lives they saved, very people who wanted them dead, who wanted to stone them. Do you have that kind of love for people? Would you do that? These people want you dead. This is your chance to be the new Israel. I'll make of you a great nation. And they said no. Incredible story. Just an incredible story. The only reason God has not brought the hammer down on this world is so that a few more might be saved, because we are willing to stand in the gap and do the work. Internalize that, brethren. God is ready to move forward, except the door is still open. No man can shut it. When it's shut, we're not going to be able to do anything about it. And we can't open it. And it'd be just as wrong to try to open it at that point as it would be cowardly, weak, and faithless to not go through it up to that point. Turn to Romans 13. Extraordinary verse. An absolutely extraordinary verse. Turn over to Romans chapter 13. We'll read three verses there. We're going to talk about a phrase, and then we'll define it. Romans 13 and verse 11. Romans 13, 11. And that knowing the time, and now it is high time to wake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us, therefore, cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Now, we all understand there is a thing called the gospel armor. This is a little different, but it's related. We understand that we, as those of Philadelphia who've anointed our eyes, can't walk around naked and ashamed, and that's a whole different but directly related point, certainly. But I would ask the question, what is the armor of light? Now, verse 13 goes on, let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying. That's going on out among God's people. It's outrageous to watch it. But you and I are told to put on the armor of light. What is that? What is it? Ephesians 5. Watch it come clear what the armor of light is. The context is the night is far spent. This is written for us to understand in this age. It truly is far spent. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 13. But all things that are reproved are made manifest by the light. For whatsoever does make manifest or obvious is light. Now, what is bringing light to the world today? We are called the light of the world, the salt of the earth. What is making manifest the world's conditions for what it is? Maybe I could ask it this way. Who is doing that? It is the work of God. We are the ones explaining the world's great problems and what are the only solutions to those problems. It's us. Wherefore, he says, awake you that sleep and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give you light. Well, that's an instruction to others who might yet choose to come with us because they recognize who and what we are. See then that you walk circumspectly. Now, you know what circum means? It means around. Spect, spectacles. It means look around. Not as fools, but as wise. Be wise as serpents, harmless as doves. Redeeming the time because the days are evil. Buying it back. That's the human factor of concern. Don't be foolish. Don't be asleep. Slap yourself. I used to notice sometimes I look at my leg. What is that bruise when I was a student? And I maybe told this story and I forgot that a day or two before I was fighting sleep in class. So, you know, I'd swim 5 to 7 miles every day, go to school. Sometimes my dad would have chores for me. And, you know, I'd sleep maybe 7 hours. And in my senior year, I was listening to Mr. Armstrong once or twice before bed when my parents couldn't hear. And I would go into class and sometimes, oh, I was tired. Try doing what I just described. 5 to 7 miles of sprint work in the water every day, 3 workouts. It would be hard to stay awake. I would bite my lip. And then I remember, oh, that's what that bruise is. I pinched myself to stay awake, and I would pinch hard, and it would buy me a little time. Now look, we have to redeem the time. You have to fight sleep. What's the response in London? Get drunk. And you've read all the scriptures about those that are drunken in the night. They sleep it off. So many of God's people got drunk went to sleep. That's what drunks do after a certain point. They pass out. Unless they drink it too fast, they can kill themselves. And certain stupid college kids do that every year in initiations and other, you know, other parties. But most just pass out. They can't drink enough alcohol to kill themselves. They don't chug-a-lug it. And that's what drunks do. God tells us, wake up. You know all those verses. Matthew 10 again. Let's go back. Let's go back to Matthew 10. Let's keep reading. Now we've asked the question, what is the armor of light? Let's keep making it crystal clear. We've tied it to avoiding utter destruction for the earth. We've tied it into God cutting the work short. We've tied it into his cutting society and the age short before everybody was dead. And mankind blew himself off the earth in worldwide cosmicide. So here we are in Matthew chapter 10. And verse 26, fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed. Being hated of all nations, remember? Fear them not, therefore, there's nothing covered that shall not be revealed and hid that shall not be known. What I tell you in darkness, that speak you in light. Now, Christ has taught us behind the scenes, if you will, in darkness. He taught those original disciples in private rooms and in, out in the highways and byways away from others. You find he often took them off alone. When they asked him, what's the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? He spoke privately to the disciples. They remained darkened to everyone else. But the result was they were supposed to go speak you in light. You go make it manifest and obvious. What you hear in the air, that preach you upon the housetops. Thunder it. The armor of light is preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God from the housetops. We cannot be stopped. There's no possible way until Christ stops us, and then there won't be a single thing in the world we can do to go one inch further. It'll be over, and we'll be glad it is. But it'll only be so for those who had their heart in the work in the meantime. John 9, verse 4. Christ said himself, setting us the example in every way. We know that's what he did. A Christian is one who copies, who emulates, who mimics, who follows Christ. I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night comes when no man can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. The only converted person after John died, John the Baptist, the only converted person on earth was Jesus Christ. What did he do? Everywhere he went, he preached the gospel of the kingdom of God. Sometimes, brethren, we have to remember part of our responsibility, a great, enormous part of our responsibility is to preach the gospel of the kingdom of God. But remember that. We can get so focused on the fact that we have to warn the seventh era. Yes, we are commissioned to warn the seventh era. Yes, we have to warn 600 million Israelites. I don't like to do that. I would rather preach the gospel of the kingdom of God and feed the flock. They're both more fun. Warnings are not fun. But we can be so focused on the warning that we forget that we have to take the gospel of the kingdom of God to the world. The leader at the very end of the age and those supporting him obviously have to do the warnings. I understand that, and there's no way to get around that. But we must work while we can. Christ set that example. Turn over to John chapter 12, just three chapters later. John 12. Now, you know what armor is. Armor is armor, whether it's the gospel armor, as it's called. Put on the whole armor of God. Armor protects you. Armor is worn for protection. Saul had armor, remember? David tried it on. It was too big. It didn't fit. He didn't have time to put on armor. Soldiers wear armor. When I was in England in February, I went over to see the Tower of London, went down through, saw all the different armor. All kinds of things that various kings for centuries wore. An incredible experience. We talk about the army and armaments. And he was an armed intruder. Our armor is worn for protection, just like everybody else's. We talk about, you know, armored vehicles. In Iraq, there's worry that they're, you know, the Humvees are not armored on the bottom. When they go over bombs, it blows through them and so forth. You understand what armor is worn for? It's worn to protect you. Now, we're told, put on the armor of light. We're coming to understand what the light is. Will we all understand that doing the work becomes our armor? Look at John 12, verse 35. Then Jesus said unto them, yet a little while is the light with you. Yet a little while is the light with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness come upon you. Yes, it can happen to us. For he that walks in darkness knows not where he goes. We are the light of the world. The light shines manifestly, powerfully. Verse 36, while you have light, believe in the light, that you may be the children of light. These things spoke Jesus. Now notice this. Look at this. And departed and did hide himself from them. Incredible. What a powerful example. As a type. It's as though Christ was saying, I've told you where I am, who I am. I'm the light of the world. I'm telling you. Then he disappeared and they couldn't find him. A stunning, shocking experience. As a type. Of the fact that suddenly things can change and you're on your own and you go forward and you do what you're told or not. Well, now, very quickly, when will the work cease? When will it be? When is it finished? Well, several things happen. Number one, and we'll be talking more about this in time to come, as you know, in the detailed prophecy series, and the last one triggered some questions, I understand. Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies. We'll know our work is over when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. Terrible bombings yesterday. The world is trying to figure out what to do about the trouble spots. The governments of men are swinging into action, trying to figure out how do we defeat this elusive enemy? What do we do? Super weapons have to be brought to bear. Thousands and thousands and millions of cameras are being set up in the great cities of the world. Their surveillance computers are looking and taking pictures. It's becoming an absolutely Orwellian society, an Orwellian society. But eventually it culminates in Jerusalem surrounded by armies. The sacrifices are ended. Well, you have to start the sacrifices before the sacrifices can be ended. I understand that. And the abomination of desolation is set up. Now, that's, of course, Jerusalem surrounded by armies, but there's another type too. And so I'll just throw in all three of those. Those will be understood later. Matthew 24 and verse 14, not later in this sermon, but at other times, and talked about it. Mr. Armstrong did, so we'll understand that. Matthew 24 and verse 14, once again, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, then shall the end come. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso reads, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. The work is over. Daniel 12 and verse 11. Let's keep this crystal clear. One of my responsibilities is to try to be crystal clear. And the other ministers have to back this up so that God's people cannot get confused where virtually everybody else is confused. And from the time that the daily sacrifice, Daniel 12, 11, the end of the book of Daniel, Daniel 12 and verse 11, shall be taken away that it is, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. All right, there will also then be a famine of the word. Turn to Amos. Amos chapter 8, verse 11. Behold, the days come, says the Lord God, that I will send a famine in the land. Not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water. That will happen too, but this isn't what he's talking about here. But of hearing the words of the Lord. It will be an absolute famine. Now, we could make a case, and I had sometimes wondered, well, are we sort of into the famine of the word? I didn't know, and I wrestled 4, 5, 6 years ago. How much of a work is there to be done? I didn't understand what my role was to be. I didn't understand that God was going to use a final resurrection, if you will, or reconstitution of his church to do a mighty work, this even remotely the scope of what I now understand we are going to do. I wondered if that famine could be sort of creeping in, and there were sort of the beginnings of it. But that's just wrong. I was wrong. I didn't understand my office. I didn't understand exactly how big we were supposed to be. There were certain things I had to go through and learn. You're the same. Mr. Armstrong was the same. There is no famine today. A massive work and a tremendously bright light can still shine from this work and is still shining. There is not remotely a famine today. I went back and restudied what Mr. Armstrong said, and I realized, you know what? I didn't represent that correctly. The famine is later. It's simply later. And our book, for quite some time, a year or better, has reflected that. Is the work finished? I always knew the work wasn't finished. I just was not clear as to how big it would be. I saw so many of God's people were drunk. So many of them were asleep. So many of them were blind. I didn't see that they were coming back. Of course, vast numbers fell away or never had God's Spirit. I wasn't sure. I tried to follow certain men. I saw they were confused. I saw they were deceived, and they were willing to deceive their people. They taught false doctrines. Didn't even understand this great servant who came, whose coming literally saved planet Earth. I knew something was terribly wrong. I knew they would talk about the work, but they didn't understand doctrines, that Christ couldn't possibly be leading them. A lot of my own family have treated me like enemies because I won't change like they will. They've sold out, and if I would just sell out with them, I'd be popular with them. It's not been easy. I have a lot of relatives in the Living Church of God, the United Church of God. I love them dearly. They don't understand what we're doing. They're confused, terribly confused. They shall wander from sea to sea and from the north even to the east. They shall run to and fro to seek the word of the Lord and shall not find it. There are people today who wonder, what happened to Mr. Armstrong? Where did he go? He disappeared. I can't find him. And now they're realizing, wait a minute. There is a voice back again. The great work is over. The short work is on. There was almost like a type of famine in a certain way. I'm not creating a new doctrine. That's not my point. People sort of went through that. And we see letter after letter after letter from people writing us and asking about, wow, I thought you guys were dead. I've actually had people write letters. I thought you guys were gone. You guys. And what happened? And people will write believing they found the same church, and they realize we're a different church, but we are the same church because we've not compromised anything. Hosea chapter 5 and verse 5. Now I'm going to be talking more about drought and famine. Some had other questions. I understand that. I can't answer everything in any given sermon. I think we all know that. But there's much, much more to understand. But Hosea 5, I'll just throw this in. In verse 5, the pride of Israel does testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them. They shall go with their flocks and with their herds to seek the Lord, but they shall not find him. Things are going to grow so bad, so horribly, terribly bad, that people are going to realize dancing drunk in the street, whistling in the dark, won't cut it. He has withdrawn himself from them. Our work will be over. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord, even some of his own people, not just physical, but spiritual Israel. For they have begotten strange children. Yes, Generation X, now Generation Sex, Credit, Pleasure, and Entitlement. We have a whole terribly strange generation of people who do awful things. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. There will be this terrible one-month famine. One-month famine. That's what it is. You don't eat for a month, you die. Tremendous, tremendous problems. Zephaniah 2. Powerful prophecies. And people are, even many of God's people who are not close to him, know something is wrong. And a lot of God's people are whistling in the dark. They're dancing drunk in the streets. They're doing the same things as their physical counterparts in Israel. They're not close to God. They're no longer children of the light. They don't understand open doors, or that the key of David is where the 10 tribes of Israel are, and that those tribes have to be warned. Let me tell you something. The watchman would have to know where those 10 tribes are and warn them. He couldn't possibly be fooled or fouled up about the key of David if he is to warn those people and he sees the sword coming. I cannot possibly get confused on that, or woe unto me if I do. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, just a few verses later, by the way, there in chapter 9, verses 24 and 27, he beat his body. That's a sobering verse for me. I now understand my office. He said he beat his body. Why? Lest he himself should be a castaway. A castaway. Do you remember that word? The end of chapter 9, verse 27. Look up the word castaway. Paul himself worried, as an apostle of God, what a lot of God's people today no longer worried about, becoming a castaway. The Greek word is adokimos, and it means unapproved. That's what the word is. It can be translated rejected. Yes, apostles can be rejected. By implication, it means worthless, reprobate, a castaway. Paul beat his body. Let me tell you, brethren, I do not intend to lose sight of what I'm to do until the door is shut. Then I won't have to do it anymore. Two people will take over. I understand prophecy. Zephaniah 2 and verse 3. Seek you the Lord, all you meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness, seek meekness. It may be you shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. Individuals can do that. It may or may not be sufficient in the way they seek him to be protected. Individuals can still make choices. This work exists for the sole purpose, and society out there is going on for the sole purpose of seeing how many yet may be hidden from the time of God's anger. If that doesn't sober us, brethren, nothing will. A couple final verses. Turn to Luke 21. Luke 21 and verse 34. Luke 21, 34, and take heed to yourselves, Paul to the disciples, who would go on to become apostles, who we read from Paul, could be castaways. Do you think, brethren, you're above what could happen to Paul? Let me tell you, there's a real message in it for me. Nobody is above the law. God does not have respect of persons. Either we are supporting the work of God or we are not. Take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that they come upon you unawares. For as a snare shall it come on all them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Suddenly. Yes, Mr. Armstrong knew he might live to see it finished. He knew it could come suddenly like a snare. You step in a snare, and as I've explained in previous sermons, you're just snapped upside down. Wham! What did I step into? What happened? Now, as we read to the Ephesians, Paul wrote, walk circumspectly, he said there. Here it says, watch you therefore, and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. The only way, brethren, you will escape is if you are wearing the armor of light. You are wearing what Paul called the armor of light. You are found so doing the work. Yes, in verse 46 of Matthew 24, 32 verses after it was talking about, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness, then shall the end come. 32 verses later, in that context, it says that the faithful servant will be found so doing, and he will also be wearing the armor of light. Finally, Matthew 24, and let's just read it. Matthew 24. Verse 36. But of that day and hour knows no man. No, we don't. No, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Nobody knows when the whole world will step into a snare and be suddenly snapped upside down. I'll tell you who won't see it coming. are the drunks. We just read about it. Those who are choked by the cares of this life because they don't care for the work of God. Those who are involved in surfeiting, that's just wild, excessive living. You read all those things. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Filled with violence, as the days were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken, the other left. It's not a rapture. Two women grinding at the mill, one taken, the other left. Just sudden, gone. Those who were watching and praying, who were wearing the armor of light, protected, and just gone. Others left, and they enter the horror. Watch, therefore, here it is again, for you know not what hour your Lord does come. Now, brethren, we can't know. The only insurance you have is if you can beat your body and remind yourself you must keep doing the work. I hope when services end all over the world, regularly on the Sabbath, at least part of the conversation is talking about the work. I'm on fire. I can't even think about anything else. My wife, we can't even talk about anything else. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have allowed his house to be broken up. There'll be a lot of people say, oh, I wish I'd have known. Now my house is smashed and I'm gone. I've been robbed and I missed out. Therefore, be you also ready, for in such an hour as you think not the Son of Man is coming. Now we've been told something else. You not only don't know, but it won't be a time you think is likely. Well, that's consistent with cut short. It wouldn't seem cut short, remember, if everybody was thinking now's about the right time. We'd say it's just right. We wouldn't say cut short. Well, here we go. Verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods, but and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, wow, this is serious to God, my Lord delays his coming. I don't have to have my heart totally in the work with the open door, understanding and acting on the key of David, warning the nations, taking the gospel of light to the world. And he begins to smite his fellow servants, to eat and drink with the drunken. That's what people in the seventh era are doing. You watch what's going on in their private lives, and I know, brethren, they are smiting one another. You watch them on the internet, they trash each other. They're full of hate and attack and division. Why? Because their minds aren't filled with the work of God. I can't understand how any of our people would ever want to go do that. I just don't understand why they'd want to get on the internet and read all that stuff. I wonder how many of our people, if the devil had a website, would say, you know what, I'm never going to listen to the devil, but I'm just curious. He's got a website. I'm just going to go check, see what he says. If Alexander, the coppersmith, had a website today, I wonder how many say, you know, I know Paul was right, he was God's servant, but I think I'll go check and see what Alexander has to say. I wonder what Jannes and Jambres have to say. You see, you know, I know Judas was wrong. He was unfaithful. He betrayed Christ for 30 pieces of silver. But, you know, I'm just going to go check out judas.org. And they type it in. See what see what's on his mind. How many today whose hearts and minds aren't sufficiently filled up with taking the light to the world, which becomes their armor of light, have time to do that sort of nonsense? I've never typed in a website, and I never will. The Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looks not for him. They wasn't looking, wasn't watching, circumspect, in an hour that he's not aware of, and shall cut him asunder and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. You pretended to be my servant, and you live this way, you hypocrite. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. All right, brethren, let's work. Plainly speaking, let's work while it is yet day. Let's walk worthy of our vocation, our calling, by doing the work of God. Let's give the whole world what could be called their meat in due season, which is the great warning we have to do, as well as the gospel of the kingdom to all nations. We are at work in all nations, as you all know. Let's arm ourselves against the coming night by putting on, in the fullest sense, strapping down tightly the armor of light, which is the preaching of the gospel of the kingdom of God to the world, including, of course, the warning of what has to happen before for those who do not yield. But let's stay focused continually, fervently, praying for an effectual door of utterance while it is yet light.